You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 9 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, how you doing this week?
Doing all right. Got my joie de vivre back.
Good. Good to hear. I'm glad to hear
I know
that.
You were concerned. You felt like there was a real joie de vivre deficit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
On Friday's Power Hour. But I got it. I'm back.
I'm glad to hear that it's back, and dare I say, nailed it. we had a big weekend of mixed martial arts, Ben. UFC 268 obviously took place out there in New York, Madison Square Garden. A lot of action, a lot of storylines extending into this Monday. We normally check in with each other, do a little banter here at the top of the show, maybe talk about some other stuff that's going on in the world of MMA. We're going to skip that this week because we got a ton of good listener mail from the people out there at home, and we want to get to as many of them as we can. So we're going to shuffle the order of the show around a little bit and just go straight into listener mail here, see how many of these messages we can get to the first half of the show, and then we'll go into our normal three-round format. But we want to start here, though, from David James over on Patreon. He wrote in, the UFC broke the record for most significant strikes in an event. The previous record was 1,818 at UFC 238, Cejudo versus Moraes. This card was evenly distributed violence with a combined 1,973 significant strikes. You know it's crazy good when John Anik yells, mixed martial arts!
Wait, is this something we're really keeping track of? Like combined significant strikes?
I'm going to be real frank with you. I did not fact check this message because it comes in from one of the beloved patrons of the Co-Main Event Podcast. I believe it. This was a very strike friendly event with a lot of action from top to bottom. Is it a valuable measuring stick, though? How many strikes or significant strikes are thrown in an entire event?
No. Because, first of all, thrown doesn't equal landed. Anyone who's ever watched a Michelle Waterson fight can tell you that you could have a lot of strikes thrown without having a lot of strikes landed, especially if you start when they're 2 feet outside your reach. But also, there's other ways that you could potentially game the system, right? Like, how many total fights do you have on the fight card? What kind of matchups do you have on the fight card? If you had a bunch of fights where they're evenly matched and they go a little while, then you're probably going to get a little bit more significant strikes. If you get a bunch of first round knockouts, then you probably won't. So I don't know. That statistic doesn't necessarily tell me anything. It is, though, one of those statistics where when you read it off, you do find yourself trying to walk a fine line between telling people, hey, we're not a bunch of bloodthirsty savages in this sport, but check out how many times people were hit in the fucking face during this last one. That's what tells you how good it was. You can make yourself feel a little uncomfortable with stats like this if you're not getting. It's the same thing whenever anybody has to throw out one of those Max Holloway qualifiers where they're like, oh, this fight had the most strikes landed if you don't count all of Max Holloway's fights, basically. Or like when Roy Nelson would set those records for like most significant strikes absorbed in the UFC and stuff like that. And you're going, what are we really keeping track of at that point?
Man, I don't know what Michelle Waterson did to draw your ire here. She's just sitting at home, didn't even fight last weekend, hasn't fought since May. She's just sitting at home, 1-3 in her last four, trying to keep her head down. And here's Ben Folks throwing grenades at her on the Co-Main Event podcast.
I like Michelle Waterson as a person. She gives you what she's got as a fighter, but she's also sort of the archetypal fighter for, she's going to start throwing strikes when you are on the other side of the cage. That doesn't deter her at all. She's just going to throw them out there anyway. We know there's some fighters out there who are known to beat the shit out of the 6 inches in front of their opponent's face. She's one of those fighters. No tea, no shade, as they say, Chad.
Well, regardless of whether or not we want to take this total strikes number to the bank as an indicator of how good the event was. UFC 268 was, in fact, a great event. You had, at one point, been six fights in a row end with either a first or second round KO or TKO all the way through the preliminary card there on ESPN Plus. Just a bunch of knockouts, basically, is what happened leading up to the main card, where, of course, four of the five fights went to decision. But at the same time, you know, you still even had some exciting ass fights. I mean, Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler went to decision, for God's sake. And that was one of the most exciting fights we've ever seen in the octagon. And so all the way around, I thought that this UFC event delivered. And, you know, we've talked a lot in the last couple months on our show about the current UFC programming strategy, which seems to be to distribute the hashtag just some fights throughout the ESPN Plus fight night events and really load up on these pay-per-views. You've got several in a row with two title fights on each pay-per-view. And you know what? I think you got to give the UFC props when they're doing it right. I feel like they actually are kind of doing it right at this moment.
Yeah.
Within the bounds of what is demanded of them for them to get their riches from ESPN. I feel like they've kind of figured out a system to do it right, because all of these pay-per-views really do feel like big, special, important events that you do want to pay for. And then you get into one like UFC 268 and it's pretty much fucking slobber knockers from start to finish. So you can't complain, really.
Well, and see, that was the point I was trying to make a few weeks ago when we had someone asking, hey, would it kill them to distribute these a little more evenly? Because you have some of these fight night events that look pretty weak. And then you've got like this main card where you could have taken Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler and made it the headline of a fight night event. And then it becomes must-see TV. But if what we were complaining about before was you are watering down the orange drink so much that you're not creating premium content worth paying premium prices for, then we can't then turn around and complain like you're saving all the good stuff for the pay-per-views. That's how it should work. And obviously the roster is not deep enough. Nobody's could be deep enough to satisfy the overwhelming schedule right now. So if you're going to have this good stuff saved for something, it should be the shit that costs $60, right?
Yeah.
And like here, you see it in action. Like this is a whole main card where you're like, yes, that in the aggregate, that is definitely worth paying for. And I think especially as people's like just digital media, like viewing consumption habits change, you have to rely on that more. Otherwise, if you just have one good fight on the card, people will be like, maybe I'll catch a pirated stream. Maybe I'll just catch some highlights on Twitter, and I don't need to pay for the whole thing. But if you're sitting down and you're telling people, we're going to offer you 2 to 3 hours just on the main card of stuff that you actually want to see and don't want to be dealing with a stream crapping out on you, don't want to be dealing with trying to find it, it's worth paying the money to see it. This is exactly that kind of fight card, and it does make a compelling argument for like why it is worth paying for.
All right, I'm going to put these two together because they are both about the same topic. This one from Brandon Boyd, who writes, after a long day of work, I needed a cold one, so I hopped on down to Cubby Sampson's for my usual Stroh's and Old Crow.
Okay, nice.
As I pulled into the gravel lot, I noticed all the neon shut off and not one light in sight. I got out of the car and walked up to the door. It was locked. I banged a few times on the door and heard a familiar voice from the other side of the door. Get the hell out of here. Bar's closed, old man Maynard screamed. Gray, it's me. Let me in. Maynard opened the door and I walked in. The place was trashed. Broken glass everywhere. Even the TV was smashed. Gray, I said, what happened? He turned to me, took a shot of Wild Turkey, took a long drag off his Pall Mall, and said, almost in a whisper, the Cheeto man got Frankie. Then he just asks discourse. Then Mr. Peanut Butter, beloved character from BoJack Horseman, follows up with his message to say, is it time for Frankie Edgar to hang him up? At this point, realistically, his title aspirations are over, and I hate seeing him take damage. What's he got left to prove? And of course, we've all seen the punch face, I guess the kick face photo of Frankie Edgar looking like a damn Simpsons character when Marlon Vera, Chito Vera, lands the front kick, third round front kick that ended this fight in a KO. It can feel smarmy, I guess, at times, or like we are being disingenuous about our true feelings when we, the fans, try to pull the rug out from under a fighter, try to cash their career in and say, hey, man, it's time to walk away. But in the case of Frankie Edgar, who is now down there battling at bantamweight after starting his career as a UFC lightweight champion. Currently, he's lost four of his last five and two in a row, Corey Sandhagen and Marlon Vera now. And a guy that we have historically liked a lot on this podcast, now 40 years old, to see him get stopped in this fashion and to see the aftermath of this fight. It was a tough one, man. It hurt a little bit. And if the question is, do we think Frankie Edgar should retire? The honest answer is probably that it's past time, I would think, for him to do that. And if the question is, what does he have left to prove? The answer is nothing, because this man was already the champion at a higher weight class, and he moved down to featherweight, and then he moved down again. And somehow Frankie Edgar still looks like the smaller guy out there, two weight classes beneath where he first started.
Two weight classes beneath where he was a UFC champion.
But there's no one out there at this point who is like, maybe Frankie can make flyweight. No, no one's saying that. Everyone is saying, maybe it's time for the old man to go home with his spectacles and his newspaper and sit in front of the fire and let somebody else do the heavy lifting for a while.
Everyone except him. Because when asked about it before this event, he was like, I'm going to be doing this to him on my deathbed. And I don't know if that was supposed to be like a feel-good moment. If it was supposed to be like, oh yeah, hell yeah, man. But then, especially when you go out there and you watch him take another bad knockout loss, you just go, I hope somebody talks you into a different way of viewing things. Because that's hard to watch, especially when you like the guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard enough to watch to people you're indifferent toward. And when you develop an affection for the guy after so many years in this sport, and you see, you know, he took that flying knee knockout to Corey Sandhagen, and that was a bad one. I mean, it was a great highlight, but that was a bad one to have to be on the business end of. And then he goes out there, takes that front kick knockout to Chito Vera, another great highlight. That's just tough to watch if you give a shit about Frankie at all. And he's in that position where he's got enough of a name that the UFC's not going to throw him a bunch of gimme fights. And even if they wanted to throw him a bunch of gimme fights, the same way we've seen him do with guys in higher weight classes where, let's say, find you a peer to match you up against. No more of these, you know, young up-and-comers who are still trying to make a name off of you, but let's find you somebody who is in the same place as you. There aren't a lot of guys like that at bantamweight in the UFC. The lighter weight classes just don't have as many older fighters in general. And so if you're looking around for other 40-year-old 135-pounders that Frankie Edgar could fight in the UFC, there's not a ton of them because they've all either retired or, you know, been shuttled out of the UFC. Like, there's just not a whole lot of other Frankie Edgar-type people for him to potentially fight. And so then, he's been in this long enough, he's making a pretty good paycheck from the UFC, people hold him in high enough regard that if they do keep him and keep offering him more fights, they're probably going to be tough fights. And so it just makes you think there's probably more of these nights ahead of him. And that's a sobering thought, because you can only take so much of that, man.
Yeah. I mean, it can only be a feel good or defiant moment when you say you're going to do this until you're on your deathbed. If the following night Marlon Vera is not out there measuring you for it and showing up with a bunch of lumber and nails, man, like that just makes
it feel...
Don't
make me laugh at this. Don't make me laugh at that, Chad.
I mean, I'm just saying that makes it feel kind of ominous, man, for Frankie Edgar to say that. And then we've got these results and the Corey Sandhagen result right before it. So I don't know. I think it's time for Frankie to have a talk with the family and find out where we're at here, because I don't necessarily know, aside from the paychecks, if there's real great reason for him to carry on doing this.
And that is the thing you wonder, right? Is you go, what is still out there that you are chasing that is a realistic possibility? Is it just the paychecks? Because if it is, you know, everybody got to make a living. And this is the one thing he's done with his entire adult life. So it's like, what else do you want him to go do now? I understand that. And we've seen, especially in this sport, where you can be a guy who is on TV for years and years and years, but then not end up with, I don't have to work another day in my life kind of money by the time you're 40. Like, that can absolutely happen in MMA. I don't know exactly what Frankie's situation is. You get the sense that he's a little bit more comfortable financially, or at least you feel like he should be, but it's still, I don't get the sense that it's just a financial decision for him, right? Like, when he's talking about fighting until he's on his deathbed, that doesn't sound like a guy saying, because I have to.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And yet, what do you think? Like, are you, do you want to be the guy who is just out there as food for somebody else? Like, you've seen that happen, especially if you're Frankie Edgar. You've been in this sport long enough. You've been watching it long enough. You've seen how that goes, man. Don't, you would think that that experience would then teach you that you don't want to be that guy.
Yeah. All right. I got this next one here from Devin Scott, who appears to have written a memo to Co-Main Event Enterprises. He writes,
okay,
Jean Vellante versus Chris Barnett had the potential to be one of those heavyweight fights where you go get a snack break after the first round. Fortunately, we got 5'9", 263-pound Chris Barnett knocking out 6'3" Jean Vellante with a damn spinning wheel kick. I'd like to expedite Mr. Barnett's application to be one of our guys. Let's go over the checklist real quick. Performs beyond what their body type suggests. Check. Highlight reel finish. Check. Yep. Front flip butt drop celebration. Check. Charisma. Check. Can dance in a style that would be befitting a scorpion bolo tie. Check. He says, I appreciate your attention to this application and feel free to add your own superlatives. Ben, at this point, we're sitting here Monday morning and my only question is, how is Chris Barnett not the biggest star in mixed martial arts? How is it that all these people will tune in to every time to watch Conor McGregor fight? And like nobody knows about Chris Barnett. This man has got it. He's got aces across the board, man. He's sitting there. Yep. He's holding four aces as far as I'm concerned. Chris Barnett should be the most popular man in sports.
They keep trying to get me to care about Greg Hardy.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hey, Greg Hardy keep coming out here, losing a bunch of heavyweight fights. They keep trying to put him up there in prime spots. Give my attention to Greg Hardy. Meanwhile, the Beast Boy, First of all, do you see this man just breaking it down during his entrance? The moves, the dance moves on Chris Barnett. I mean, how much do I have to pay to just like get Chris Barnett at a wedding? Just to come tear it up on the dance floor? He didn't even have to stay for the whole time.
Yeah, what's like, his appearance fee? Let's find out what this man's appearance fee is and get him at our events.
Yeah, you're having a party. You want somebody to come liven up the joint. Like, imagine everybody standing around in the kitchen at like 11 p.m. at a house party, the way people are doing. Everybody's had a few drinks. Chris Barnett comes through the door, just giving you the shake, you know, tearing off his shirt, front flipping onto his butt. And he's just like, hell yeah, man. Like, light up the room, Chris Barnett. Also, when he shows up afterwards and explains that the way he came up with some of these moves is, you know, capoeira, taekwondo, stuff like that. But also, whenever he is watching or like playing a video game, like a fight video game or something where they're doing a move, and he's like, I know somebody had to wear one of those motion capture suits and actually do that move. And so when I see a cool move, I go, somebody must have been able to do it. Let me see if I can do it. And then he goes off and pulls it off in a heavyweight UFC fight and then explains that in his mind, he is 170 pounds.
Yeah.
You can say what you want. The scale can say what it wants. In his mind, he's 170 pounds. And that, I'll say that's the kind of attitude that I think we could all use a little more of. You know? Like, whatever, you're some middle manager at work or whatever. In your mind, you're a Fortune 500 CEO.
Yeah. Chris Barnett appears to be out here asking, why not me?
Yeah.
And the answer is no reason, Chris. Go on and do it.
You're asking girls out at the club. You know you're a solid 6, maybe a 6.5, but in your mind, you're a 10.
Why?
Go get
not em. Me. Chris Barnett now 1-1 in the UFC after he caught a bad one against Ben Rothwell in his UFC debut, which would be a tough assignment for any damn buddy trying to make their first UFC fight. Now he gets this win over Jean Vellante in Jean Vellante's retirement fight. Nothing not to love about this man as far as I'm concerned. And since you brought his name up, I will say right now to the UFC folks listening down there in Las Vegas, because I know you're out there, if anyone breathes a word about you trying to get my man Chris Barnett to fight Greg Hardy, I will make signs and I will come down there and I will demonstrate in front of the UFC office building. Do not try to do this. Do not take this from us. We need Chris Barnett out there in this world, living this life. Let us have it. Number two, did you see when he came to the post-fight interview and was talking about how he likes to go online and research his opponents because he likes to find stuff that he can hate about them? to motivate himself. So he did a deep dive on Jean Volante and then reported he couldn't find anything to dislike about Jean Volante. He was like, he's a football coach. He takes care of his kids. He was like, I had his football players messaging me being like, this man is a legend. We love our coach. And then he was like, except one of those players needs to do a little extra running. Because he was like, maybe you can do me a favor and knock my coach out on Saturday night. But it's just like, you just watch Chris Barnett do these interviews, and it's life-affirming, man. The man, he's just got to talk about joie de vivre. Yeah. Man, that's, you're getting it all over the place from Chris Barnett, and I couldn't possibly love it anymore. And if you don't give me 10 fun fights in a row that this man can win, I don't even know what we're doing anymore in this sport.
Man, how do you not hear that as Jean Volante and that show up to practice on Monday and be like, all right, which one of you?
That's right. We're going to do the Herb Brooks. We're all going to run sprints until you cough up the name of the guy who wanted to see me lose this fight.
Yeah. Which one of you is the Judas who wanted to see the Beast Boy knock me out?
But hey, man, and then again, Chris Barnett, then he demands that the UFC puts Jean Volante on the mic, which, like, I don't always love it when concussed guys get interviewed after the fights, but like, this is the man's retirement fight, man. Yeah. And you got his opponent out there being like, I would like to concede my time to the gentleman from New York. Like, just yes. class all the way around from Chris Barnett. It's just amazing. Amazing performance. Ben, we got one that came in from Edmund Shabazian.
Okay. Good to hear from him, I guess.
Yeah. Edmund Shabazian writes, will I ever make the top 15 again? Also, why are people always hating on me? So, Shabazian.
Are people hating on him?
I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, he lost this one to Nassourdine Imavov, and he's now, for the first time, obviously, in his career, lost two in a three in a row. First three losses of his professional career. Derek Brunson singing and dancing Jack Hermanson, and now this. I told you, when they line you up with a 25-year-old Dagestani guy who's 11-3 now overall, that's bad news, man. That's bad news for you. Don't take that phone call when they call you about the 29-year-old streaking Dagestan guy. Don't take that fight. But I don't know. I mean, if anybody's hating on Edmund Shabazian for anything, I could see it being one of two things. But maybe that he's training down there with the Red King, the Dragon King, Edmund Targaryens, back at the Glendale Fight Club where they used to have Ronda Rousey. I could see some people, you know, maybe they just don't like that. And maybe being one of the guys who for a time felt like he was one of the chosen UFC up-and-comers that was going to get that shine from the promotion. At this point, you got to throw that out the window, though, I think, with these latest bookings, man.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, is when you look at how the kind of fights he's ending up in, it looks like someone is trying to ruin the guy because he's only 23. And, I mean, maybe some of it is just these are the perils of too much hype too soon in this sport, because he came up, he was undefeated. You know, he looked really good finishing off guys like Jack Marshman, Brad Tavares. But then you put him in that Derek Brunson fight, and it didn't feel like it was because you wanted to see Derek Brunson come out and win. But then Derek Brunson does. I mean, like, Shabazian looked phenomenal in the first round, but then Derek Brunson is a veteran of the sport with a well-rounded game, and he was able to put it on him and wear him down and finish him off. And then after that, it's Jack Hermanson, another like solid, experienced, top-level fighter. And then this one where you're like, let's just find a tough-ass Dagestani guy who will elbow you in your head like it is made of candy. And he's trying to get to the gooey good stuff inside. And like, it seems like that's like you're setting this guy up to just get completely smashed before he even really finds his legs under him as a pro fighter, which that does seem a tad ironic when the whole thing was supposed to be like, okay, he's coming with the Dragon Kings. He's got Ronda Rousey as like his manager or whatever. It's like the thing that seems to be missing is some real forward thinking career planning for Edmund Shabazian.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he does seem like physically, like he has good tools, he has good gifts and everything. Like if you give him a chance a little bit, it does seem like he could develop into something. But this just feels like we're not really giving him a chance.
Yeah, I don't totally understand it either, because you're right. Like the quickest way to take a guy who seems to have a high ceiling and a lot of potential and some good skills and run him straight into the ground is have him fight a bunch of a bunch of guys that are kind of out of his depth. And that sort of does seem like what's happening here with Edmund Shahbazyan. I guess we'll have to, now that he's on this 3-fight losing streak, we'll have to see where he goes from here, if the UFC will continue to get him fights and who they want to match him up against with in the future. Because to the extent that there's any political capital to be gained by using Edmund Shahbazyan as like a stepping stone, I think that's probably gone at this point. So now do you circle back and try to give him some fights where he can build himself back up? Like, he's young enough and early enough in his career that he's certainly not out of it by any stretch of the imagination. So if you pulled an Aaron Pico here and we're kind of like, all right, let's slow our roll, let's give this guy some fights where maybe he can build himself into something, he certainly wouldn't be a lost cause. But that also strikes me as kind of like a non-UFC move at this point. But yeah, if anybody's worth it, it would probably be a guy like Edmund Shahbazyan, I would think. The other side of the coin here, Ben, we got an email here from Bono, I believe, of course, to use the lead singer of U2. He writes in, Ian Gary looks good, doesn't he? He seems to have all the attributes to become a massive star. The nickname, the future, needs changing ASAP, obviously. But otherwise, how far do you think he can go? Ian Gary, Ben, is a guy that the Irish folks have been talking about for a while now. Undefeated, coming out of Cage Warriors, made his UFC debut on Saturday, defeated Jordan Williams in his first octagon appearance, first round KO, just right before the bell at the end of the first round. But yeah, this is a guy in this division, 23 years old, if I'm not mistaken, and he's a guy that the people overseas have been real excited about, and seems to be a guy who, again, like Edmund Shahbazyan at one point, seems to kind of have all the potential and the highest ceiling you can think of. And here he is getting matched up against Jordan Williams, who I believe came in on the heels of back-to-back losses. He did. Yeah. One of them obviously to Nassourdine Imavov and then to Mickey Gall. And now he loses to Ian Gary. So kind of like the other side of the spectrum here, where you get the undefeated Irish prospect and you give him a guy that seems like the right kind of matchup for his UFC debut.
Yeah. And he comes out and he looks good and lands a clean punch to get the knockout there. Is the future such a bad nickname? Because I know we sometimes urge people against any sort of like time-based nickname, especially right, if it involves like young, like don't ever be the young anything, because that will change. Wonder Boy, that kind of stuff. But the future always exists, no matter where you are. There's
That's
always
true,
a future.
But I think it has sort of like a baby-faced assassin kind of potential, where if you're okay, Josh Barnett, eventually you have to wake up one morning and look at yourself in the mirror and be like, looking more like a war master at this point. Graduated up from baby-faced assassin to war master.
Yeah, when you grow a big burly beard, that helps. Yeah.
Right. At this point, though, I don't think there's anything wrong with calling Ian Gary the future right now. Like, maybe if we get to a point where he feels more like the present, then we talk about maybe a switch. But this is okay with me for now. I've heard worse nicknames. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I mean, and then it lends itself to a bunch of cool catchphrases where you're knocking people out, talking about the future is now, shit like that. You know, it gives you some room you could work with. And also, like, the future, just as a concept, like, is always, like, the promise of the future is always right there for you. No matter how bad things might be going in the present, there's always the future.
I agree. Looking forward to Ian Gary, seeing where he can go. He's out here talking about how he thinks Khamzat Chimaev will be the champ and it'll be the two of them fighting for the belt. So interesting to see if that prognostication can come true. All right, let's do one more. Let's squeeze this one in from Dan Alexander, who writes, well, I understand both the sentiment and the strategy. The idea, as both McGregor and Covington have put it, that it's, quote, all about the money, seems like an excuse for some outrageous pre-fight talk once they're having their asses handed to them in the octagon. Please discourse. Now, obviously, Ben, we'll talk about Colby Covington a little bit later in the show, but we see this a lot, and we've talked about this before, but outrageous pre-fight trash talk, either at the time or later, being justified by saying, hey, man, we're just out here trying to sell pay-per-views, which is a weird explanation when you think about it for a number of different ways, but especially if you're a dude like Colby Covington. And you can lay some of this at the feet of Conor McGregor. And we just watched the Muhammad Ali documentary from Ken Burns on Doing the Damn Thing a couple weeks ago, and we talked a lot about how, despite the fact that Muhammad Ali has been this symbol of social justice and this revolutionary kind of figure in our culture, he did a lot of kind of like racial trash talk leading up to some of his fights. You've seen, obviously, Colby Covington kind of make his thing, that he has hitched his wagon to this Donald Trump ultra-conservative movement in America. And now, sometime later, he's coming back and say, well, I'm trying to sell pay-per-views with Kamaru Usman here.
Yeah.
And I would proffer, doesn't matter. Doesn't make any difference if what you're saying or what you're doing is what you feel in your heart, or if you're just trying to do it to make money. I'm not going to say it's worse, because I don't know if you can get worse, but to me, it's the same.
Well, especially if your position is, I was only acting like a dickhead for the money.
Yeah. That's not good.
No.
That's not a good explanation. That doesn't make it go away, man. We're not like, oh, okay, I got you. I get it. No, you know what? It's fine. It's actually fine. We thought about it. As long as you made a bunch of money, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a dickhead for pay, it still makes you a dickhead. Like, it just means that you were working out a compensation package for your dickheadedness. But also, the one thing you shouldn't be able to do is come out and say, in close to somebody, hey, it was just about the money. That's not going to work to make him feel better towards you or anything. And then you can't then afterwards turn right around, go to the press conference and be like, he's a cheating asshole. And like, I didn't get a fair shake. Cause it's like, man, we heard the other thing too. You know, did you know there are microphones all around the cage? Did you know people heard that? Because you can't let down that mask and be like, I'm not really the asshole I am pretending to be, and then be like, oh, they need me on stage? Okay, real quick, let me put it back on and go out there and be the asshole. It doesn't work like that, man. Like, the one thing that you ought to be forced to do is to wear that mask everywhere. Like, that, if that's the bargain that you want to strike, if that's the trade-off that you think is worth it. The same thing before, man. Remember when he got jumped in the buffet line? When Usman and Ali Abdelaziz rolled up on him?
My favorite Colby Covington moment to this day.
He's standing there wearing his cargo shorts
and his t-shirt on, and he's got a look on his face like, man, I am not on the clock right now, you guys.
It's just like, hey, I'm this is my personal time. And it's like, no, man, for the persona that you were trying to adopt, there is no such thing. Like, you adopt it under your own name. You go around telling people that this is who Colby Covington is. You don't get to just take it off and put it on when it suits you. You have to wear it everywhere. That should be part of the deal. And they should all understand that when you do it, especially when you do it fucking poorly, like Colby Covington has done. And so, no, you don't get to just be like, hey, it's cool. Like, don't take anything I said seriously, because, hey, if you're doing it for the money, it means you're trying to create this emotional response to you. It won't work if people think that it's all fake. Like, you won't generate the response. And if you do generate the response and get the emotional response that you want, you can't then be like, but I don't want to deal with any of the fallout from it. No, man, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah. Remember the lead up to Mayweather McGregor, where also there was a bunch of regrettably racial trash talk, but like the whole thing was like, we're doing this fight because we want to make a ton of money, and man, yeah, are we gonna make a ton of money off this pay-per-view. Bring the money belt out, the winner of this fight gets it, because we're gonna make so much money. And the whole time,
let's literally throw some money in the air.
The whole time I was sitting at home being like, that's my money.
Yeah,
that's our money, they're talking about getting.
That's what they mean,
talking about taking our money. It's just a weird promotional weird way to do it.
We're cheering it like, yes, you will have our money.
Take our money. All right, well, that's going to do it for listener mail this week. We got a ton of good listener mail this week, so thanks to everybody who wrote in. Sorry we couldn't get to more of them. I would kind of like to just sit here and keep answering them, but we got bigger.
Especially just so we could say stuff like the plant-based platypus.
Yeah, we got a lot of good mail, and we got to get on to other topics here. But thanks, everybody who wrote in. And remember, if you want to air your own question, comment, or concern to the Co-Main Event podcast, you do it by going to our website, comainevent.com, and clicking the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Remember, you're listening to the Co-Main Event podcast proper. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines or podcast libraries. And if you think we're having a good time right now, you should check us out over on Patreon, patreon.com/co-main-event. Ben Folks and I are over there with three additional podcasts all week. We got the Wednesday live chat. On Thursday, we're doing the damn thing. On Friday, we have the Friday Power Hour. We have fun over there. We do the occasional live fight party, and we have a Patreon tier, a tier of giving for every budget. So check us out over patreon.com/co-main event. If you want to join the team, we got music this week from our guys, Foreign Cash, an LA-based production duo. If you like what you hear from Foreign Cash, you can check out more of their stuff at foreigncash.bandcamp.com or soundcloud.com/foreigncash. And as you guys know, the word cash is C-A-C-H-E, Foreign Cash. Three rounds now, as usual, in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number one, we will try to find words for Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler. But frankly, it seems like the kind of fight that would be best described by like a Rorschach test or some kind of mid-century expressionist art, or maybe like a funeral dirge composed by one of the great masters. But we'll do our best. And in round number two, in a very close fight for the strawweight title, you could argue Zhang Weili had the more impressive individual performance, but Rose Namajunas knew all the right moves to win a 5-round championship fight, and she made all those moves, and still. And in round number three, perhaps the best metric we can use to describe the rematch between Kamaru Usman and Colby Covington is that every second of every round, it seemed like Covington was trying as hard as he possibly could just to stay in the fight. And Usman? He was just kind of cruising. All that plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff, but right now, we are going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Ben, I can't think of a better way to start round one here than to simply share Justin Gaethje's words in the cage from after this fight, when he said, "We are living in the wrong times, let me tell you. Me and him should have been fighting to the death in the fucking Coliseum." And normally, I might eschew such sentiment here in the professional sports fighting world of mixed martial arts, but gotta tell you, I watched this fight, and then Justin Gaethje gets on the mic and says that, and my initial response was, yeah, that seems right. That seems right. It's so rare that a fight like this, a fight that we looked at and we thought, fight of the year potential, absolute banger, these two guys are going to bring it, and then it goes out there, and it's everything you thought it was going to be and maybe more. It was just like, it was so good, I don't even know what to really say, other than the fact that It lived up to the hype and then some.
Yeah. I that's what I thought in the immediate aftermath of this fight was my expectations were high, very high, and somehow it exceeded them, even in a fight that didn't give us a finish.
Yeah.
Because here's where you might say, Chad, everybody got to do their stuff. Justin Gaethje got to almost lose before he then won. You know, Michael Chandler got to show you that he is tough as shit and that even after, you know, he takes a tremendous beating, he can still just come out and pop you out of nowhere. You know, everybody just like good old fashioned violence for the sake of violence. As people have pointed out afterwards, Justin Gaethje himself, a guy who started off 1-2 in his first UFC fights after coming to the UFC with a little bit of head of steam from what he'd done in another promotion. Michael Chandler now, 1-2 in his first three UFC fights after coming with a head of steam. And yet, as was the case with Justin Gaethje, nobody is looking at Michael Chandler after those particular three fights, especially with this being the third, and going, well, he sucks. Yeah. This was a bust. Nobody's saying that.
Yeah, and nobody is saying, I don't want to watch him again either. Like, this is one of those rare times where, you know, you might have taken some time off the old life meter or off the career meter with the damage you took in this fight if you're Michael Chandler, but zero people are looking at this and thinking that Michael Chandler has less watchability or less capital or less potential in the division now than he did before this fight, which is kind of remarkable. I didn't know that we would be having that conversation going into this thing, but you know, like I said at the top, it lived up. Both guys got to do their stuff and both guys come out of the thing kind of smelling like the rose. I think Michael Chandler, I thought, won the first round, and for much of the early going, he was obviously the more explosive athlete. Justin Gaethje was doing the thing we knew he was going to do. He was scoring consistently with his low kicks. He was landing that uppercut, which was nasty.
Yeah.
I think he proved himself to be the more technical striker. The low kicks that he always throws are just sneaky and deadly. I actually liked during this fight Daniel Cormier pointing out that Justin Gaethje doesn't get enough credit for how technical he is, and Joe Rogan immediately saying, he's very technical, but he's also crazy. And I was like, okay, that's vintage Joe Rogan right there. Mm-hmm. Like a guy who has been taking a lot of heat lately for his commentary and other aspects of his life, but that was good Joe Rogan right there. There's a point in this second round, man, where Chandler sort of got lucky. They didn't stop the thing. When Gaethje floored him with that uppercut, but you know, it was a big Daniel Mergliotta, I think, was in there with these guys. Mike Beltran. I'm sorry. Mike Beltran was in there as the referee, and Chandler was making moves and looking like he wasn't out of it. But if he had come in and stopped the fight right then, I don't think anyone would have asked too many questions about it. But instead we get to go on like and have this this third round, where frankly it seemed like Michael Chandler just kind of lost his mind in it.
Yeah, you know, like I think 9 out of 10 UFC lightweights eat that uppercut from Justin Gaethje, and that's it. That one should have been over right there. And also like Justin Gaethje, I think, where he had some shaky moments there early on against Michael Chandler, and it just shows you like the what it takes to be at that level to use it. It's not just like that you got to be a good experienced fighter, because kind of everybody you look around at that in the top 10, top 15 or so at the UFC lightweight division is that. And it's not just that you got to be like tough as shit, because everybody's tough as shit too, but you got to be all those things all the time. And it's incredible like that the difference between those two guys is very small in that fight. It's not like one of them is absolutely blowing the other one away. Like they both come in there, and there are moments early on in that fight where it seems like it could swing in either direction. And when the margins are so razor thin in some of those matchups, it's got to feel especially tricky psychologically to go into those fights knowing that and having experienced that in your career. Because what do you tell yourself to give yourself confidence that you can do absolutely everything right leading up to it, make a bunch of good decisions in the fight, and still, you know, you eat one shot and it changes everything. And so it's kind of incredible to see both those guys put on that kind of a performance, especially knowing everybody is expecting you guys to have a complete slobber knocker, and yet both your careers kind of hinge on whether you win or lose in this moment to an extent. So you got to give us a crazy show and take a bunch of wild chances, but also don't lose.
Yeah.
Like that's an incredibly difficult spot to be in. And I don't know, maybe the right attitude is the one that Justin Gaethje has espoused before, which is to be like, look, I know fighting the way I do, I won't win them all, but we'll worry about that later. We're going to dance with who brung us here. And it's exactly that kind of a style. Because it's amazing to me that Michael Chandler is still there in the third round, still, you know, telling him like getting hit with a good one and being like, all right, yeah, bring me more of that. And you think it's just posturing, and then he'll come back and he still has some snap in his punches, even after all that damage that he's taken. You're like, okay, this guy is still in. That guy is still like a possible threat to get you. But if you're Justin Gaethje, that is the exact way that you make the point. Like, don't even come at me with this Islam Makhachev shit, bro.
Yeah.
Don't even talk this stuff about somebody else wins a fight against a lower ranked lightweight and maybe they jump me in line for this next title shot. Like, no, that was the perfect way to slam the door on that entire discussion. Because anybody sees that, they're going to be like, Gaethje got next.
Yeah.
I don't care who it is. Don't care who wins that title fight between Chucky Olives and Dustin Poirier. Whoever it is, Gaethje got next.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I was spent by the opening of the third round when Michael Chandler somehow is out here harnessing the energy for like a scoop high crotch slam in the third round, and Justin Gaethje just immediately takes his back. Just incredible stuff. It seemed like down the stretch in this thing, maybe Michael Chandler had realized that he was gonna drop this one on the scorecards if it went the distance, and so he became a bit of a showman in there after that, dropped his hands. He was waving Gaethje in. He was waving the fans on. He was, at the end of this thing, throwing, like, jumping spinning kicks and shit. And I was just like, wow, man, that guy's in good shape. Michael Chandler, you wouldn't know to look at him, but that Michael Chandler is in good shape.
Yeah, how about that?
But yeah, it seemed like, you know, I thought he played it exactly right too and was a good sport afterward and all that. But I think you're right, man. We got UFC 269 coming up now on December 11th with two title fights once again. And of course, the main event there, Charles Oliveira against Dustin Poirier. And regardless of who wins that one, it seems like Justin Gaethje should have next. He's obviously fought Dustin Poirier before, a fight that you and I recently watched from back in 2018. We watched it over on our Patreon page. Wouldn't mind watching it again. Right. Running that one back is just fine. I have no idea how Justin Gaethje has not fought Charles Oliveira at some point, but that would be a fresh matchup. So kind of either way that one turns out, I would be excited to watch Justin Gaethje have that one. And Michael Chandler still alive and well in this division, as far as I'm concerned, as more or less a top contender, regardless of the loss.
Yeah, I agree. You might want to take a little time after, because that's the kind of fight that seems like it could take years off your life.
Yeah, yeah. You might want to listen to Kamaru Usman, take some time off to spend with the family after that one. But just the rare fight that exceeded our already high expectations. So bravo to both those guys. Let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me here, Ben, and then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, Dylan Danis has been taking some L's recently.
Oh, man.
My man. You know, has the altercation with the bar bouncer. He's allegedly trying to get in to see his buddies from a wedding, which I don't understand. Couldn't get in. Maybe Dylan Danis wasn't that well liked at the wedding either. I'm just spitballing. I'm just throwing out crazy ideas. But then this Saturday at UFC 268, he allegedly gets slapped backstage, not by a fellow fighter, but by MMA manager Ali Abdelaziz, allegedly slaps this man in the face. And then, if we can believe the accounts, Dylan Danis is escorted out by UFC security. And according to a deleted tweet from Michael Bisping, banned from future UFC events, which you got to do some shit to get banned from the UFC, man. But yeah, you know you are the asshole when you are the one who gets slapped and you get thrown out. You fucking kidding me? Dylan Danis, what you doing? You fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me? Man, for a guy who hardly ever fights anymore, he stays taking L's, man.
Yeah, he has not fought since 2019, and he arguably needs a W worse than anybody else in this entire sport. It's crazy. You fucking kidding me?
Chad, are you fucking kidding me? Tell me you saw this clip of the biggest of homies, Francis Ngannou, strolling around backstage.
Yeah.
And he walks right past Ciryl Gane, standing there, you know, and gives just a little glance over to the side. The camera's following Francis Ngannou, at least to start, as he walks down the hallway. He glances over to the side, just kind of keeps walking. And then the cameraman, excellent, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm style camera work, pans back to Ciryl Gane making a what the fuck face. Like, he's just going to act like he didn't see me standing here? Like, he looked right at me, kept walking, didn't even acknowledge that I am a person who exists in this world. And you could just kind of hear the just like panning in on his face. He seems genuinely hurt in that moment.
Yeah.
It's like, it is both somehow an awesome cool guy move on Francis Ngannou's part on some straight up Ford Maddox, Ford a gentleman always cuts a cad bullshit, just to give him that glance and then just keep on strolling right on by without a word. But then Ciryl Gane, like, he even kind of raises his hand like with his mouth open, like, what? What the fuck was that? Like, he gotta act like he don't know me? The fuck? Are you fucking kidding me? You just, like, nobody needs to say a word in that moment. Everybody's emotions right there at the surface.
Yeah. Well, and Ciryl Gane is standing there with Fernan Lopez.
Yes.
The guy who brought Francis Ngannou into MMA and was his first trainer in Paris and brought him to the UFC. He was the guy, when I did my story on Francis Ngannou, they were the two guys hanging out at Francis Ngannou's apartment, like smoking and joking, being bros. And now it's like that's just somebody that he used to know.
Yep.
I guess.
You want to become Francis Ngannou's enemy, it means he's going to barely glance at you as he walks on down the hallway.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? Wow. All right, that's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Chad, Rose Namajunas had to put in a little more time at the job this time in the rematch against Zhang Weili. Last time, you know, we're going to look low, kick high, get out of here in a little over a minute. This time, 5 minute, five rounds, full job of work. And yet, she has to get smart, has to get a little veteran savvy down there. She manages to get it done when she needs to, pulls out a narrow decision victory to retain the UFC title. First of all, how'd you score this one?
I mean, honestly, this was such a close fight, man. If you told me that you thought Zhang Weili won all three of those first rounds, I couldn't quibble with you that much. But I think, you know, it was another one of those fights where, just like you see in the lighter men's division sometimes, both fighters are so fast and they're both exchanging combinations and everybody is landing and the grappling is back and forth. And all these rounds just seemed very close to me. I think Rose won the fourth and the fifth from the top, pretty obviously. That takedown that she landed in the fifth was as big a fight stealer, as big as like a signpost, as big a signpost moment in a fight that you will ever see, that takedown in the fifth. But I mean, it all kind of came down to how you scored the second round, right? I think, because like the first and third, I thought were pretty solidly with Weili. But, you know, this is, like I said at the beginning of the show, this felt like one where maybe you could come away with it thinking that Weili Zhang kind of had the more impressive performance, but that Rose Namajunas hit all of the proper notes in order to win a five round fight, hit all of the proper notes at all of the proper times with Pat Barry and Trevor Whitman in her corner, like kind of telling her to do it. And she executed and she wins the fight. Like, I couldn't quibble with the decision. If I was Zhang Weili, I might think maybe I got robbed a little bit. And if I was the UFC, man, I would start to wonder if maybe we had painted ourselves into a corner here a little bit with Zhang Weili, because it's like, to give her this immediate rematch and have her come back and lose it, you kind of put yourself in like Max Holloway type territory here now, where like, I don't know that you can have her fight Rose Namajunas again unless she is able to go out and like get another couple of wins over other people. So like, if you were trying to position Zhang Weili as your champion, which again, we don't know that's what the UFC was trying to do, but like, it seemed like they were pretty high on her. Like, man, she's in kind of a tough spot at this point. And I kind of had to laugh, to be honest with you, that John Anik, who, you know, I love the man's work, he's the best announcer we've had in mixed martial arts, he began this fight by asking, will we get closure? And I was like, closure from what, man? Like, Rose Namajunas knocked her out the first time. Like, did the UFC set up this fight because they thought that in the first one, Zhang Weili would have won had she not lost? Because if so, man, you put her in kind of a rough spot now that she's got back-to-back losses to Rose Namajunas, who just kind of keeps seeming like she's getting better and better. And by the way, does not turn 30 years old until next summer.
Yeah, I mean, the closure thing was a good one, because it was like, will we get closure or will we set up a trilogy, was the thing he was saying. And you're right that it was like, I don't know, somebody goes out there and kicks somebody in the face in the first round, knocks them out. Like, that does feel like the matter's kind of closed.
Yeah, and I thought most we had other, closure the first time. You can't have more closure than that in this sport.
But then this fight was so close that, if anything, you feel like there's a little less closure than you started with. Yeah. And especially like this one, I scored at 3-2. In which direction? I'll never say. Because it was just one of those fights where that's a 3-2 fight. And it's up to us to argue over who gets the three and who gets the two.
Yeah.
And you're not going to convince anybody of any other position than what they felt like they saw that first time. And especially some of those rounds where it comes down to, hey, Rose ends up on top for most of the round. And you could argue, yeah, she's not doing a ton. She's not doing a ton of damage from the top. But you also go, yeah, but then what do you do? Do you give it to Weili? because she's on her back not doing a ton of damage either. Like, it's so tough to call some of those rounds. But then you look at what Rose Namajunas' title reign and just like her time at the top of the division, either as like a top challenger or as the champion itself, has looked like. And it's like, you know, you had the two fights back to back with Yuana and Jacek, two fights back to back with Jessica Andrade, and now two fights back to back with Zhang Weili. And so it feels like there's just a hunger to see her do something else.
Yeah.
Kind of anything else.
It's time to break out the T-Pain meme for the UFC matchmakers as it pertains to Rose Namajunas' career, man. Let this woman do something else. We've already seen it. Do something else.
And yet, the fight that, if this worked like a real sport, like where, you know, you win the quarterfinals and you move on to the semifinals, if it worked like that, then an obvious thing to do would be Carla Esparza next, which is itself a rematch. Granted, a rematch from like 7 years ago, so you don't have that same fatigue of like, oh, we just saw this kind of thing. Plus, it's a rematch where she lost, Rose lost the first one, and so like, here's a chance to go and get one back. And the UFC, though, already kind of talking sideways out their mouths about what we're going to do next. When it seems like, I mean, I get it in a way. You're looking at gate receipts. You're thinking about who's going to bring you those sweet, sweet pay-per-view buys. And you look at Carla Esparza and you'd be like, that ain't it. Like, she's not the one who brings a ton of hype to these fights. And yet, how do you justify at this point doing anything else without basically saying, the wins and the losses we view as mere suggestions?
Right. And it's not like the UFC badly needs those gate receipts or pay-per-view buys at this point. You make that the co-main on some other pay-per-view, you probably do just as well as you would with it with anything else. Like, it feels to me like Rose Namajunas has earned that, if that's what she wants, is to like have, you know, to let her do something else again, to like give her some fresh matchups, let her try to get that win back from Carla Esparza. I don't understand how you would. I don't know what other direction you go. Rose Namajunas said that she thought Carla Esparza would be next before this fight. So I don't know what else you do or what else you book or who you bring in to have her fight. But I would like to see Rose Namajunas move on to some new business, frankly, after this series of rematches that she has had. And if you somehow messed around and like did another Zhang Weili fight or something like that, then I would start to get a very specific, you are going to make Rose Namajunas fight this person until she loses kind of vibe. And that's not what you want if you're out here trying to book your mixed martial arts promotion.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, the Dana White's comments about how like, you know, it's not a good idea to sit around and wait for title shots kind of thing. Like that makes you wonder, like, is there a vindictive element to this? Is that what you're trying to say? Like, hey, she should have just be out here taking fights because we told her to, and to spite her, we're not going to give her a title shot, even if she deserves it. Because other people have sat around and waited for title shots, and it worked out pretty okay for them.
Yeah.
You know? It's been tried before. It's worked.
It's very surprising that the man who owns the UFC would be of the mind that you should just fight as many times as you can and make as much money for the UFC. That's the thing to do. It's very surprising that he would feel that way. Ben, did Rose Namajunas say during her post-fight interview that she wants to start Earthship Academies?
I'm sorry, what was that?
I believe she said, I just want to fight Earth, or I just want to start Earthship Academies, when she was asked in the post-fight by Joe Rogan what she wanted to do next.
I feel like I understand what all those words mean individually. But together in that order, something doesn't add up for me. Do you know what that means?
Well, I have the internet in front of me.
You're going to plug it into the internet. See if the internet can tell us what that means.
Earthship Academy. The Earthship Biotexture Academy offers extensive training in Earthship design principles, construction methods, and philosophy.
Okay, see, you're still telling me words that I know,
but you have recently talked to Rose Namajunas about her love of the earth, about farming, and all this stuff that she's into down there in Colorado.
Farming. She's big into sustainable farming.
Okay, so I think that's where we're going with this. That's why I asked you the Earthship question. Like, I thought maybe you, from your earlier conversations, would know what an Earthship Academy was, because it either sounds like an awesome sci-fi Harry Potter kind of thing, like Star Trek and Harry Potter mashed together, or it's a bunch of people trying to save the planet, which, you know, either way, it seems cool.
Yeah, okay. I was really hoping that we were talking about a rocket ship made of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Earth ship.
Mm-hmm. Hunk of Earth flying through space.
Why not?
I mean,
says an Earth ship can't leave orbit, right?
If you're Rose Namajunas, your two options are, I don't know, maybe fly through space aboard a ship made of solid dirt, or come back and fight Carla Esparza. She's game for either.
You know what? As far as, like, outside interests go for a UFC fighter and a UFC champion, let's just say right off the bat that sustainable farming is kind of the most wholesome ass shit and the least offensive shit that we have no right to even expect. Like, normally, you find out what a UFC champion gets up to in their off time, and it's going to be, you know, like, video games, guns, attack dogs, shit like that. Somebody else is going to come along and be like, I'm really into this sustainable farming initiative. Like, fuck. By all means.
Yeah.
By all fucking means. Also, though, before we move on from this topic, did you hear Zhang Weili talking about how she had prepared for the acrimonious U.S. crowd? Like, the hostile reception that she would get, which we had heard, you know, she maybe was not totally prepared for the first time she fought Rose. And her former manager, I believe, was talking about how she had heard a bunch of racist shit on her way to the cage and back from the cage.
UFC before. I heard a bunch of racist shit when I was there.
And how, like, she actually, like, built it into her preparation, a hostile U.S. crowd. And she was like, hey, I understand the way, like, it took me some time to understand that it's not like they dislike me, because I was confused by that. I didn't know what reason I had given them to dislike me, but it's just because I'm not one of their countrymen. And you go, wait a minute. I remember watching Rocky IV, how the Soviets are real hostile to Rocky when he comes out there. But then, by the end, you know, I can change, you can change, everybody can change. That's the whole takeaway lesson, except in real life we're learning, like, nope, people still going to be assholes to her. Like, that's just fucking sad, man, that we make it so that somebody, like a Chinese fighter, has to prepare in her training camp for racist ash invectives to be hurled at her. Like, that's part of her psychological preparation for fighting an American in the United States of America. Because that doesn't say great things about us.
No, it's a sad commentary. And Zhang Weili seems like a lovely person from what we know about her to this point. And that is a sad commentary. And welcome to sports in the United States, I guess. That's going to go for round number two. We'll be right back with round number three. Well, Ben, it's not like Colby Covington didn't have a bunch of nice moments in this fight against Kamaru Usman, because he absolutely did. But like I said at the start of the episode, it kind of felt like he was that cat. You know, the hang in there poster that everyone had on their walls in the 80s, where the cat is just hanging by its claws? That kind of felt like what Colby Covington was doing here. Just hanging by his claws, trying to stay in this fight, while Kamaru Usman had it in cruise control and was just, you know, bettering him at every turn. Colby Covington, to his credit, rallied to have some good moments down the stretch here in the final three rounds. Like, weirdly, I feel like his best moments came after we had all kind of decided that Kamaru Usman was going to win. And so that was, you know, some bad timing from him. But at the end of the day, you emerge with the same welterweight champ we had going in. Kamaru Usman wins this thing, unanimous decision across the board. 48-47 times two, 49-46 once, and now has vanquished Colby Covington twice. So I guess my opening question is, where does this leave Kamaru Usman? Because people are saying some pretty wild things about where we should think about him in the grand scheme of the welterweight division and the history of this sport. And what do we do with Colby Covington now, who seems to be a damn good fighter, just not good enough to be the champion right now?
Yeah. And, I mean, to address the Colby Covington issue first, it seems like after getting dropped, what was in the second round where he gets dropped and again feels Kamaru Usman's punching power, and after that point where it's, he clearly knows, I got to be careful, I can't take clean shots from Kamaru Usman. But Usman, as the fight is going on, is increasingly confident that if he has to, he can take clean shots from Colby Covington. And like, Covington is trying to find a way to push the pace like he likes to do normally, but also you can tell that he is wary. He knows that I can't hang my chin out there and get clipped by this guy because I've just, it's going to lead to nothing but trouble for me. And his fighting style doesn't have a way to deal with that necessarily. It's kind of like being like a run heavy football team. If you fall behind, it doesn't always give you, like, your style doesn't lend itself to like big comebacks, amassing big points in a hurry to erase a deficit. And he has kind of that same thing where his style is momentum, pressure, pace.
Yeah.
And if he can't do those things because he has to worry about like, well, I can't run right into that guy's fist, he's going to knock me out, then he has to adjust and find some other way to win and some other way to fight. And he just couldn't quite find it. And I think that, I mean, he still beats a whole bunch of welterweights in the UFC division right now, but there's just no interest in seeing him fight Kamaru Usman again. And it seems like Kamaru Usman could very well be the champ for a while.
Yeah. There was actually a moment, even in round two, even before Covington got dropped, and you got the sense that if there was a minute or 45 seconds still left on the clock in that second round when Kamaru Usman landed those shots, that thing might well have been over. But there was a time even before that in the second round where Colby Covington threw a 1-2 combo and Kamaru Usman slipped both of them while barely moving and just blasted Colby Covington up the middle with an uppercut. Where during that exchange, I thought to myself, thanks for coming, Colby, because this one seems like it's over. But like I said, he rallied and had a nice showing, and I think that all of that is to his credit, and he is a good fighter who should continue to have, you know, fight the people in the contender ranks, but at this point has had these two losses to the champion, and I think it will take some time to rehabilitate him into a place where he can fight for the title again. The more interesting question, I think, is Kamaru Usman, because people are telling us Kamaru Usman is the greatest welterweight of all time, which I don't think he is. Dana White, just like he always does, and every time a dominant champion fights in the UFC, is telling us this guy is either the greatest of all time now or is knocking on the door of being the greatest of all time. And I'm just not seeing it yet. I see a guy who like, is incredibly good, and it, technically speaking, maybe is the best welterweight we've ever seen. But like, I'm not sure he has a resume at this point that can tempt me with boosting him above George St. Pierre or ensconcing him as the greatest at any weight of all time or what have you. And so the question becomes, what do you do with the guy? Because he's 20-1 overall. He hasn't lost since 2013. He's undefeated in the UFC. He keeps whipping these welterweights. We're sending him the best welterweights we can find, and he's beating them over five rounds without ever really feeling like he cranked the volume all the way up to 10. What do you do with the guy? Because my feeling is Kamaru Usman has sounded like he's not going to be around forever, especially right now. He wants to go spend some time with his family. He said some touching things about his daughter, which was nice to hear. But what do you do with the guy? I feel like you got to find something big to do with Kamaru Usman basically right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you need to find something to do with him right now, especially when I heard him at the post-fight press conference. You could really sympathize with him when he was talking about how I've been away a lot this year, fighting a lot. I mean, like, you don't see every single UFC champion who clocks three title defenses in a year when, you know, like in less than a year, really. And so when he's talking about all this time away from his daughter and he's like, she's 7 years old, like, you know, we both have daughters around that same age where he's right. Like, they do really notice when you're gone and want some explanation as to where the hell you are. And he's spending a lot of time away for these fight camps. And he says like, hey, I need to be around a little bit more for a while. I don't think that's the worst thing you could do at all. Because Kamaru Usman goes away for a little while, goes home for a little while, spends some time with his family, and let welterweight figure out who it's going to send as its next emissary.
Do you even have him fight a welterweight at this point, though? Like, if it's Khamzat Chimaev, that might feel like a big deal. But if you're like, I don't mean to imply that Kamaru Usman needs to get back in the cage immediately. I don't think he does, and I don't want to see him do that. But I feel like his next fight should be something momentous. If you were going to continue to feed me this line that he's the greatest welterweight of all time, and he is potentially the greatest of all time at any weight, you got to give me something that feels big. Give me something that feels special with this guy. And what that is, I don't know. But like, if he's just going to come out here and fight the next version of Colby Covington or whoever is at the top of the heap at welterweight, I don't know, man. He's going to have a bunch more of those fights if I'm going to accept him as the greatest of all time. He seems good enough that I want to see him do something interesting and meaty and eye-opening.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. You got Kamaru Usman at the top, right? The UFC rankings on at least the UFC's own official rankings as of right now look like this. Colby Covington, number one. Gilbert Burns, number two. Leon Edwards, three. And then it's Vicente Luque, Stephen Thompson, Michael Chiesa, guys like that down the line. If you're Leon Edwards, you're probably going like, hey, don't go too far. Right. Like, I'm playing, you know, I got to win one more, fine. But then you're not going to win one more me to death. You know, you're not going to be able to tell me forever, like, hey, this one and then title shot. Okay, one more and then title shot. Like, I need the title shot after this next one if I win. And so he is probably going to be feeling like, I want my shot. I've earned my shot. Where is it? And, you know, you could understand. Like, in some ways, maybe it would simplify things if he lost. And then you could be like, okay, we're starting over. We're taking new applications at welterweight. But I get what you're saying, that you need to feel something like we have somebody that presents a new, big, scary challenge for Kamaru Usman. And usually right. The answer for that has been like, have him go up and wait, super fight against another champ in another division. You know, he and Israel Adesanya aren't really into the idea of a super fight against each other. So that seems like a little bit of a hard sell to begin with. I think maybe the answer is just like giving it some time and seeing how things develop in that division. Because who knows, if you can get Khamzat Chimaev a couple quick fights and he keeps demolishing people, and the next thing you know, it's, you know, June of 2022 and he's sitting in the top ranked spot at welterweight after a couple more absolute wreckages of people, that might feel like a big scary challenge, like the young guy coming after Kamaru Usman.
Yeah.
But it is a tough thing now, because when I hear Dana White out there being like, oh no, he's better than GSP, like he's the best right now, and all I hear is he's the guy we can make money off now, so he's the guy that we're going to push.
Right.
The other guy, we can't make money off him anymore, and so we're ready to shovel some dirt onto his legacy if it means creating a higher mound for the other guy to stand on. But I don't know if anybody's really buying it. Like, you do need to have that one big rival that you overcome, and I don't know if Colby Covington necessarily ever captured enough of the public's imagination to feel like that.
Right. In a way, I feel like you almost do a disservice to the guy if you're just out there blowing smoke about his position in the history of the sport or whatever. But I suppose if Kamaru Usman was around long enough to run a gauntlet that included Leon Edwards, Vicente Luque, maybe Michael Chiesa, and Khamzat Chimaev, that would be impressive. That would be a very impressive resume. I just feel like he's talented enough, and he's kind of blowing the doors off everyone, that I would love to see him face a challenge that felt really special. And you look around the UFC landscape right now, and I just don't know what that is, unless it is indeed Chimaev at some point in the future. But I feel like you need to put some more road under Chimaev before he starts to feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't feel like you're there yet.
All right, let's do Just Saying Stuff, and then we'll get out of here for this week. Ben, what is your Just Saying Stuff?
Well, why don't you do your Just Saying Stuff first, because I feel like mine's going to have something to say about yours.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Very well, then. Well, we saw Dana White at the post-fight press conference come out there. Somebody asked him if he had seen the Canelo Alvarez fight, which happened the same night as UFC 268, and Dana White said, yeah, he'd watched it at cage side. Assumedly on his flip phone or whatever it is he's carrying around.
No, we saw an image like somebody took from behind him in the crowd where you can see him clearly watching it on a computer screen.
Oh, they brought him a screen.
Like a monitor. Yeah.
Reporters asked him if he paid for it. And Dana White was like, he basically was like, sure. He basically gave the same answer that somebody gives you if you're like, hey man, you still on that diet? Still doing that diet that you were talking about a few weeks ago? And I guess number one, Ben, like, you could use this as evidence that Dana White doesn't care even about his own product. That he's sitting there, he's watching Canelo Alvarez at UFC 268. You could make that point. Or you could say, you know, it's hypocritical of him to like dog these pirates all the time who are stealing the UFC event, talking about how basically like he's going to become deputized and kick the door down at their house and arrest him for pirating the UFC. You can make that point. I'm just saying, I don't feel like Dana White has ever felt more relatable than in that moment where he was like, yes, I watched it. And someone was like, did you pay for it? And he was like, far as you know, I did. Far as you know. Just saying. I feel like that's a superhuman moment for the UFC president.
I'm just saying, and I wrote about this, but you could read about it on comainevent.com right now, but I broke down the reasons to believe that he did pay for it, reasons to believe he didn't. And my conclusion, Chad, is that Dana White has no fucking idea if he paid for that or not. Dana White isn't sitting there pulling out, like opening up a laptop and being like,
you don't think he got it on his credit
streams
card?
And he's not going to showtime.com, like taking out his credit card there at cage side and being like 441. Like, he's not doing any of that shit, man.
So he what you're telling me is that somebody in a tuxedo, a waiter wearing a tuxedo and white gloves, brought one of those like metal serving dishes with the domed top, brought it out to cage side, set it in front of Dana White and said, Mr. White, your pay-per-view for the evening, and like lifted it off. And then the screen was just in there showing the Canelo fight.
He said to some UFC underling, I want to watch this Canelo fight. No, during my fights, I want there to be a screen that shows me the Canelo fight so that I can watch it while these other assholes are fighting for UFC titles in front of me. I got $100,000 riding on this thing, man. I need to watch this fight. Make it so. He was on some Captain Picard shit, just being like, I want to watch this fight. Make it happen. And then it was up to whoever else to decide how we are going to get a screen in front of Dana White that shows the Canelo Alvarez fight as it's happening. That's all he cared about, man. He didn't specify how that shit was going to happen. He wouldn't know how to get a pirated stream of some shit if he wanted to, man. Dana White, I'm telling you, doesn't know how to set an alarm clock in his own house. He's too rich for that shit. He is 52 and he is rich. Those two things add up to equal you not knowing how to do a goddamn thing for yourself, especially technology-wise. There is no way he could set up his own illegal stream of this fight. And he's also like not going to get out his credit card and order the shit. So like somebody else did that shit for him. And he's just in the moment. That was the first time he even thought about, did we pay for it? Did we get this? And I'll bet they did, solely because a UFC underling was like, well, I don't want to be the one he turns and angrily at with his face turning different shades of red when the stream craps out. So, like, let's go ahead. Let's just put it on his credit card. He'll never notice.
He his credit notice card,
70
come on.
Bucks.
There's no way they put it on his credit card. They put it on the UFC company account.
If you ask Dana White, like, hey, what do you spend on food in a given month? I don't think he could ballpark it within $10,000. There's no way he's going to know. Like, he's not aware of whether you paid for some shit, you didn't pay for something. He just said, make this thing happen in front of me, and then waited for it to happen. He didn't even consider the question until some reporter asked him. That's what that was before he said yes, was it him just realizing, like, it never occurred to me to even ask if we were paying for it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Just saying. You make a compelling case. That's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event podcast. Remember, we'll be over at the Patreon page, patreon.com/co-main-event, all week leading up to this weekend's action. So check us out over there. As for right now, though, thanks everybody for listening. We are done. We are through. We are out. So the intern that has to get the pay-per-view for Dana White, do you think that like Dana White watches it on the intern's laptop? Do you think the intern is like, oh, does this have to be on my laptop? Or do you think there's like a laptop in the UFC that has like a piece of duct tape on it that has like Dana piracy laptop written on it in Sharpie, and that's the one they use? Or like,
well, I mean, if you see the photo that somebody took from behind him, you can see it's like he's looking at a monitor, went full screen, and now we're on full screen mode to watch it. So I don't know what the actual source device was or something, but I think they could probably be pretty secure in the knowledge that Dana White doesn't know how to like hit the escape key.
There's some intern who's like, oh, I gotta log out of my emails. So he doesn't see my emails to Joel Morgan. I gotta close my Twitter. He's like, oh man, this is a hassle. Comes back all covered in chip crumbs, probably. I don't know.